remembering the popular revolutions of 2011.
The experience of the revolution and those kind of rather wonderful, incoherent, crazy, chaotic, you know, violent, yes, but also creative and effervescent months, I think allowed Egyptians for the first time to question authority, to debate among themselves, to challenge ideas and shibboleths, and to really kind of reassess what they thought, where they were getting their information from, what they were told, what they believed. There was a huge amount of debate and questioning that went on.
That's Wendell Stevenson talking about the Egyptian revolution that started in Tahrir Square. Her book about it is Circling the Square, Stories from the Egyptian Revolution. Then we re-air our 2011 interview with Marina Citrin about Occupy Wall Street. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. While this show was being produced, Egypt's military regime pardoned two jailed Al Jazeera journalists who had been sentenced to 3 years for reporting on the Muslim Brotherhood. It's always good news when journalists are released from prison. Not so great is that they were put there in the first place for doing their job. The Egyptian military overthrew President Mohamed Morsi in July of 2013 and has gone on to establish a draconian counter-revolution to the popular uprising in Egypt that began in January of 2011. To recap in brief, Morsi had been democratically elected in the vote that took place after Egypt's previous strongman, Hosni Mubarak, was toppled by the uprising. But Morsi lost little time in establishing a repressive regime that took away many freedoms, including the right to demonstrate, that the Egyptian people had fought so hard for. Then the army went even further. It's easy to forget in these days of increasingly autocratic rule in Egypt just how powerful and hopeful the People's Revolution was. My guest, British journalist Wendell Stevenson, was there. Her book, Circling the Square, is an electrifying account of that time. Her passionate personal perspective and on-the-street storytelling put the reader right into the middle of what's happening. Through those stories, we get an understanding of why the revolution happened and how it was undone so easily. It's also a vivid picture of the creative ferment and chaos that infused popular democracy in revolutionary times. Wendell Stevenson reported on the Egyptian Revolution for The New Yorker. She's reported on the Middle East and the Caucasus for The Guardian, Prospect Magazine, Slate, and other publications. Wendell Stevenson's two previous books are Stories I Stole and The Weight of a Mustard Seed. I spoke to her in August. Well, Wendell Stevenson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This is a very strikingly written book, Circling the Square, Stories from the Egyptian Revolution. You adopt a very particular voice and tone that makes it very clear that you have a passionate and had a passionate interest in Egypt and what was going on there. I'd like to ask you, why did you have this passion even before you got there?
Well, I'd spent a lot of time in the Middle East, probably about a decade and a half all in. I was part of the generation of journalists who were kind of thrust into the Middle East post 9/11. And I had lived in Tehran, Baghdad, Damascus, Beirut. I'd been to Cairo. I knew the region well, and it was always a source of great frustration to me and a lot of my Arab friends that much of the region was sort of stuck between tyrants and religious fanatics and between foreign meddling and war and invasions. And there didn't seem to be much of a voice or an impetus or a movement that would suggests that that could change. And so when it happened in Tunis and when the crowds began to gather in Tahrir Square in Cairo, it was just extraordinarily exciting. And I think, you know, I think it was exciting for everybody around the world. It was a hugely sort of televisual event with flag waving and shouting and banners and freedom. It was a very sort of easy concept to understand, people finding a voice, denouncing, shouting, wanting something better. And for those of us who've been in the region that had seemed so stymied for so long, so stuck and stagnant and stuck with sort of bad choices, it was enormously exciting. And I just desperately wanted to see it and be part of it and watch that happen.
The real pivotal moment was the Day of Rage. I remember watching that on TV. As you say, this was such a remarkable televisual event, and being just overwhelmed by the incredible courage that I saw there. People who were confronting death, really, at the hands of the police, but just kept on coming and overwhelmed them. I mean, it was a remarkable moment. Tell us about the Day of Rage. Were you there at the time, or did you come soon after that?
I think I arrived that evening or the day after. I can't remember exactly. I arrived, it was still very obvious. It had just happened. And I remember I arrived at night. It was dark. The streets were extremely uncertain. There were checkpoints of residents, local residents everywhere. Everything was very scary. And I remember going into the hotel and going up onto the balcony, and I could see Tahrir. I could see there was still a dark pool of black smoke rising up from the old party building that had been Mubarak's party, that had been burnt on the Day of Rage. And the army had deployed tanks all the way around Tahrir Square. It was completely unclear quite what they were doing, but they were noisy and grinding. So there was this pall of black smoke over the city and just the noise of tanks growling. And that was the first thing I saw. The Day of Rage was a Friday, and it was called after the initial demonstrations on Tahrir had been sort of successful and exciting, and more crowds had gathered than people imagined. And the police, who had usually always managed to contain these kind of demonstrations because they were regular in Cairo, the demonstrations were called for police day, and there were always demos on that day, but they were small, there were a few hundred people, and they'd be outnumbered by police. On this day, what with the Tunisian example and a certain frisson in the air and a kind of contagion of possibility, they weren't. And it surprised and excited and encouraged huge numbers of people that the police were on the back foot that day, and they kind of took a step back and allowed crowds to gather. Then the crowds on Tahrir sort of dwindled a bit, but a huge demonstration was called for the Friday, which is the Sunday, the day of prayer, and so the day off, and when demonstrations are often called. And nobody knew what would happen. There was a lot of fear about violence because there had been violence on the initial day, on the 25th of January. So there was huge trepidation, but there were just more people than ever before. And I think the crowd was amazed and encouraged and surprised by that. And there was a huge camaraderie of marches and people trying to get through police cordons onto Tahrir, because Tahrir is on one side of the river. A lot of people were coming from the other side of the river. There's an island of Zamalek and bridges in between. And so there got to be these bottlenecks on bridges over the Nile, trying to get into Tahrir. And it was relatively easy for the police to cordon those access routes. And that's where the choke point and the battles were the fiercest. And you're right, it raged for hours, and barrage after barrage and sort of ebb and tide of demonstrators would go forward and be pushed back by a sort of barrage of rubber bullets. And the police would drive their little kind of tin can sort of riot trucks into the crowd to disperse them. Lots of tear gas, cracking, sort of rubber bullety gunfire, beatings, stampeding. It was very frightening. And what was curious about the Day of Rage was that it seemed by the end of the afternoon, by about 5 or 6 o'clock, it seemed that the protesters had won and had got over the bridges and onto the square. But in fact, the police had sort of managed to hold them all through the day and to hold the crowds back and had the sort of monopoly of violence on the situation, had the violent control of the situation. But at some point, somewhat mysteriously, the police just stood back and kind of vanished. And the crowd swept forward, and it was a night of rampage and burning and sort of cacophonous celebration and confusion. And really, that was the moment when a revolution happened. But it happened almost by an internal mechanism of collapse rather than by what looked like from the outside and seemed like at the time, too. It was only afterwards that we were able to kind of piece together kind of what had happened. It seemed that it had been an overwhelmingly democratic people versus police victory. But in fact, people got onto Tahrir and occupied Tahrir and stayed on Tahrir because the police disappeared. Quite why they disappeared and the mechanism for that, or quite what happened, is not entirely clear. It's been said that in some cases maybe they got overwhelmed, but they all disappeared from all over Cairo, all at the same time. And at the same time, the head of the Interior Ministry was arrested and certain senior figures in the police establishment were arrested. And so it was sort of as if the police had been decapitated. And for the remainder of the occupation of Tahrir until Mubarak's fall, the police were just nowhere and didn't exist. So then the forces were the people on the square and the army. And then the question became, what on earth is the army going to do now that they've got the square surrounded by tanks?
Right. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But I'd like you to read a section, a paragraph from your book, Wendell Stevenson, from Circling the Square, Stories from the Egyptian Revolution, which I think really beautifully describes the kind of ferment and chaos and popular democracy that was bubbling over at that time. It starts with, the paragraph starts with the crowd. So set us up for a moment and then please read that.
Well, I think this was part of the kind of effort of trying to understand what I was looking at when you're looking at a sort of sea of people and a lot of people, colorful, chaotic, creative, funny, curious, lots of different things going on all at the same time. And it's a sort of curious thing, a revolutionary crowd, because it's made up of individuals all with different ideas, but it also makes up a single organism. So you have this sort of constant sort of many versus unity, multitude versus one sort of tension going on. And I think this is sort of part of my effort to capture that or describe that. So the crowd was a single thing, but it was made up of individuals. And in each Egyptian head resided several competing opinions. Calm down versus burn down. Islam as sanctuary, as mantra, as terrorism. Army, good, bad, the only solution. Strongman, pharaoh, regime, parliament. What does a prime minister do? Voting with your feet, running away, from, toward, around the corner to catch your breath. This was as true for an army officer stationed at a Cairo crossroads, or a pro-Mubarak thug, or an official of the ruling party, as it was for the revolutionary youth. Every day, Egypt would wake up and have no idea what it would do that day, or what would happen. Events hung between one possibility that was active agency, and another that would be delivered as fate, which is to say, by Allah, or the powers that remained, but which was to be accepted as beyond your control. For some Egyptians, this was the freedom of their own blank page to write. For others, it was terrifying and mystifying and exhausting.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Wendell Stevenson about the Egyptian People's Revolution of 2011. Her book is called Circling the Square. That is such a vivid description. You quote somebody in the book saying, "The fear is over." Talk a little bit about how does this process move people to overcome their fear? I mean, I just wonder if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, we would talk about it quite a lot because you could see it happening. And it was a sort of extraordinary thing to witness, because the fear is very real. I mean, if you demonstrate, I've been in demonstrations, you know, in the Middle East many times, it's terrifying. It's pretty scary as an observer to be part of it, to be somebody, you know, standing up in a small crowd. There was always sort of, you know, 100 or 200 or 300 people surrounded by a larger number of plainclothes and police and riot police dragging people out indiscriminately. You know, you might get beaten and chucked in jail for a few days, and you might be locked up for 10 years. I mean, the consequences were real. And so to find people sort of discover that they could shout, that they could rail, that they could complain, they could denounce. There's a great expiation and joy in that. And to see people doing that for the first time was just, it was joyous. It was wonderful. I think that the overcoming in fear had a lot to do with the numbers. There were a lot of them. They were together. The numbers grew. So incrementally, word spread and, you know, no, come down. It's okay. They're not shooting anymore. No, you can. We're all here. Come. I'm telling you, it'll be all right. And even I remember, you know, people, because it would be different in families. You know, one person would go to the square and their parents would be like, no, I don't want you to go there. It's dangerous there. They'll be shooting. And then they would come back and be like, no, mum, you've got to come. You've got to see. And then the mother would go and be like, oh, yeah. So that it grew like this, by word of mouth, by people being together, by people encouraging each other. And also, they had a very, you know, strong and easy, simple message: Mubarak, leave. So it was, nobody was having to wrestle with the complications of governing or democracy or political parties. It was clear. It was pretty universal. You know, Mubarak had been in power for 30 years. He was old. It was, you know, stagnant. It was annoying. It was repressive. You know, the economy was not great. There was sort of corruption, all the usual stuff. And so, he was a very easy target and a broad one. And misgivings about his rule were widely shared. So I think that it was a collective moment, and it was marvelous to see Egyptians discover that themselves. There was this, my favorite chant on the square was, "You're Egyptian, hold your head up. Hold your head up, you're an Egyptian." And there was sort of, there was pride in this, almost for the first time, that instead of having to sort of, you know, be content with a kind of slightly scrabbly, down at heel, second rate governance and existence, you could hope for something better, and you might be able to be part of that. There was agency and great power in the discovery of that agency. That was what was so exciting and beguiling about being on the square in those 18 days and the fall of Mubarak. Afterwards, of course, everything got complicated and violent and incoherent and, you know, awkward and conspiracy driven and all the rest of it. But there was a great magic in those days, those initial days. And I think all of us who were there will kind of keep the experience of that in our hearts as a kind of touchstone, as, you know, what is possible, what sometimes can be, despite all the usual cynicisms of why it probably isn't going to work.
Yes, as you say, the fact that the revolution had no leadership at that point was an advantage, but it turned to a disadvantage. And I remember the moment where I had a kind of an intimation of coming doom. And that was when I heard the people shouting that the army and the people are one hand. And I thought to myself, oh my God, that is so incredibly naive. Could you talk about that chant, and why did people make it? What was the sense then, and how that got so completely betrayed? I mean, that's a huge answer wrapped up in one question, so maybe just take it in part.
The relationship of the revolution and the army is a complicated one, but suffice to say, if we go back to the first moment, which I think I describe in the book, where you had the tanks were deployed, the police had disappeared, the tanks were deployed around Tahrir. The people were on Tahrir, but not in vast numbers. There are several thousand, but Tahrir is quite a big space. You know, it wasn't an overwhelming number of people. And the tanks, you know, they're big armoured things, and they make a noise, and they're threatening, and they have big guns mounted on them. And it wasn't at all clear what they were there to do or what they were going to do. And the people began to sing to them, to co-opt them. And it was an extraordinary scene to watch, because the people were a little bit frightened of them, but at the same time they were appealing to them as Egyptians, they were appealing to the soldiers, they were appealing to the army as the protector of the nation, as the foundation of the state, which it had been since Nasser took over in 52. You are with us, you are of us, protect us, be with us. And, you know, it was wishful thinking in a way. It was also strategically important and clever in a way, because if the army hadn't been with the protesters, there wouldn't have been a revolution. They needed them. But I think it was also inevitably naive, because it wasn't until some months later and some months after, into the rule of SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which took over, which is essentially the army taking over after Mubarak de facto in the interim period. It wasn't until a few months afterwards that kind of most Egyptians suddenly had this kind of like moment of realization of, hang on a second, it was the army that was there, the regime. It's not Mubarak one guy, it's an institution. And then you got a lot of demonstrations against the army and against Tantawi, who was the general who had taken over from Mubarak as a de facto interim leader. And then the tide turned against the army, and a lot of people sort of began to grapple with what the army was and what it was trying to do and where it stood in the Egyptian polity. I think that the army had always done a very good, I mean, it's essentially a military regime and had been since 1952, but the army had always been very good at taking a sort of back seat, pretending to be an impartial, apolitical force. Meanwhile, the president and vice presidents, although Mubarak didn't have a vice president, but a lot of ministers and governors were essentially just generals who'd taken off their uniforms and put on civilian dress. So the control, economic, politically, was always in the army's hands. It wasn't clear to a lot of Egyptians until some months later, the reality of that.
And yet then there was a transition period. I mean, there was an interim period.
Yeah, there was a year and a half before they had presidential elections that was complete chaos. From a journalistic point of view, it was, you know, fun as hell. It was constant roller coaster of convulsions, of political, now we're going to have a constitution. No, not that constitution. No, we're going to have a referendum. No, there's going to be parliamentary elections. No, the rules have changed. It was switched back. It was confusing. And it was against a backdrop of sort of continually erupting demonstrations, violence, all sorts of incidents that would spark out of nowhere. And it was roiling. It was very incoherent. It was very chaotic. It looked for a long time like this was the sort of interim period during which things would be sorted out. And in fact, after a year and a half, there was a presidential election. And it looked like that had been free and fair, and that the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, Mohamed Morsi, was duly elected. He went to Tahrir Square to sort of acclaim or affirm his election. And even though that election and his victory was very divisive, it looked like that could be a conclusion to the revolution and to the interim and to the turmoil. And now you get on with the business of governing under a new regime and reforming. But that didn't happen.
Right. That didn't happen. I mean, for one thing, it seems like Morsi himself became kind of a petty dictator. He outlawed all kinds of democratic things and, you know, cemented the role. Well, first of all, he said he put the presidency above the constitution. Talk a little bit about that. And also, what do you think was the army's stance during that time?
That, I mean, that's a very difficult thing to answer, because you're trying to sort of, you know, figure out what the Egyptian army is doing or thinking is a bit like Kremlin watching, or trying to figure out, you know, what's happening internally in you know, the upper echelons of the Iranian state apparatus. It's not, you know, it's not a transparent process. They don't talk about it. And you get sort of odd gleanings and rumors and sort of, you know, stuff that only seems indicative after the event. It's very hard to tell at the time. So Morsi is elected. He's a Muslim Brotherhood leader. He's not very well known. He's not charismatic. He's not the greatest politician. You know, I'm sure he's a perfectly nice bloke, but he didn't have the kind of chops and wherewithal and political talent to be able to kind of grasp a very complex situation and create a vision and build political bridges and create a kind of reform platform or program, and to articulate that in a way that could move people with him. Although the Brotherhood has a strong constituency in Egypt, it's not the majority. It's hard to sort of gauge its support, and now, of course, it would be much less. But at the time, it was maybe 20 or 30%. This was the sort of figures that they would be getting in elections and so forth. So a lot of Egyptians were always suspicious of them, suspicious of their agenda, suspicious that they would introduce all sorts of kind of social measures to Islamize the country in a way that would be awkward and repressive and not in keeping with the Egyptian culture mainstream. And I think that they also, with some and justifiably, had a lot of misgivings about, you know, how democratic is the Muslim Brotherhood. They had never been able to show a program of reforms that organized a kind of political setup for their vision or their ideology. And they had won the presidential election narrowly with sort of 52% or so, and seemed to think that this, you know, gave them the country, that democracy meant that when you won everything. So the idea of a kind of, you know, multi-party, of pluralism, of, you know, of compromise, of all the kind of stuff that in Britain and America, you know, you work in over centuries and imperfectly clash and figure it out somehow. This was not either in the Egyptian culture, and certainly not in the Muslim Brotherhood rule book or playbook. And so I don't think they had a very good program or idea what to do, and they certainly weren't able to take the country with them and to articulate it. In the meantime, you've got the reaction forming against them. The reaction is partly popular and partly, of course, inside the army, who, you know, if there's one thing the army doesn't like historically, it's the Muslim Brotherhood. They've played a sort of, you know, cat and mouse game with them ever since Nasser took over in 52. Nasser used the Brotherhood to come to power and then 2 years later imprisoned them and executed their leaders. The relationship between the two has been strained, to say the least. So the idea of the army being so, you know, being subject to a Brotherhood presidency was always going to be an awkward, to say the least, fit. It looked like Sisi, who became defense minister a few months into Morsi's presidency, had somehow convinced Morsi that he would be amenable, helpful, and played a very clever game while moving against him and while moving certain forces in the media and in business and fomenting and encouraging sort of popular and grassroots opposition to Morsi. Of course, Morsi, you know, and the Brotherhood made plenty of mistakes themselves, not least, as you said, of trying to sort of shoehorn in their own self-serving constitution and all of this kind of thing. But the army had tried to do exactly the same thing before the presidential election. So I think it was a political crisis of the Brotherhood were unable to articulate a political vision for the country that could take people who were not natural Brotherhood supporters with them.
And now we have a situation where, you know, Morsi, is it right that he faces the death penalty or was?
Following the convolutions of the Egyptian court justice system can sometimes be slightly confusing. But as I'm aware, I think he is under sentence of death. Yes.
Right. And demonstrations are outlawed. I mean, if anything, it seems more draconian than it was even under Mubarak.
It is. It is more draconian. It is far more repressive than it was under Mubarak. There's no doubt about it. Thousands of Brotherhood have been arrested. There have been, you know, mass trials. Lots of sentences of death have been thrown out. Protests have been outlawed. The media has been curtailed. They've gone after journalists to intimidate them. They've gone after and a number of liberal activists who were big, you know, part of the original revolution and the youth and the Tahrir youth. The big names from that are either out of Egypt or have been intimidated or in prison. There's no doubt, I think, that the repression under Sisi is far greater than it was under the final years of Mubarak. I mean, it's inevitable that when you get a revolution and then a counter-revolution, which is maybe a grandiose term for what this was, but in some respects what this was, you know, he has to clamp down, there has to be a crackdown, he has to, you know, get things under control, and that's what he's doing. The Egyptian army is very effective at controlling. They've been doing it for over 60 years, and that's what they're doing. It's very clear to my Egyptian friends that I talk to, as I said, a lot of whom are out of Egypt, a lot of whom, you know, for example, those who worked with NGOs and in democracy building organizations are now, you know, out of work. A lot of those have been closed down. For them, it's very clear that the message is do not stick your head above the parapet. Do not make political waves. Do not complain. You know, we are now getting back on the right track. We will have stability and everybody will shut up.
So do you feel that all is lost, that the revolution was in vain, or is there anything that, you know, still has remained or that you can see some, you know, for want of a better word, hope for the future?
Hope for the future. I mean, this is the Middle East we're talking about. So hope for the future, not this week, no, unfortunately. I think I can't see, although I would never predict, have the temerity to predict anything in the Middle East at the same time because it can surprise you. I can't quite imagine the army or Sisi loosening their grip or anything changing politically in Egypt in the near future. They have consolidated their control. Sisi is very popular. I think that Egyptians understandably look to Libya and Syria and say, thank God we're not them. And that stability, you know, is not a small thing. And that's what he's offering. And to some extent, although there's a fair amount of sort of terrorist backlash, inevitably he's delivering it. And so I can't see it politically changing. I think Sisi is here to say the army has reestablished control. But on the other hand, when people ask me this question, I like to answer by saying that the experience of the revolution and those kind of rather wonderful, incoherent, crazy, chaotic, you know, violent, yes, but also creative and effervescent months, I think allowed Egyptians for the first time to question authority, to debate among themselves, to challenge ideas and shibboleths, and to really kind of reassess what they thought, where they were getting their information from, what they were told, what they believed. There was a huge amount of debate and questioning that went on. And I kind of hope and believe that somehow the experience of that is, you can't take that experience away. You can't erase it. You can suppress its expression, but you can't take the experience away. Egyptians had a taste of what it's like when you throw everything up in the air and you look around the corner and you try and do something in a different way. It was very frightening, I think, the chaos and the instability of those years. But at the same time, it did open a lid, crack a door in people's hearts. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence, a lot of my friends, a lot of people I talk to of, you know, daughters questioning their place in society, girls wanting to live on their own, even people questioning their teachers, their university professors, their fathers, all of a sudden the kind of, you know, de facto blanket authority of I'm older, I know better, I'm the government, I'm your father, I'm your boss. All of a sudden the absolute of that was scratched up a bit. The image of that as an absolute was scratched up. And I think a lot of Egyptians got the experience of questioning authority. And I think that may just survive in people's hearts. And maybe someday they'll be able to express it again. And, you know, that this reaction will be like a lot of reactions after revolutions, you know, a sort of, it seems like a step back, but it's also part of the process on figuring out how you want to live, how you want to organize your political structure and your polity and what kind of country you're living in.
Well, that is a hopeful note. And I think you describe in your book, Wendell Stevenson, Encircling the Square, you really bring such a vivid portrait forward. It's a very exciting reading. Before we end, just a last question. There was a review, I believe it was in the New York Times, where the reviewer, you know, gave you kudos for the writing of the book, but then criticized you for, I think he said that you, I don't know the exact quote in front of me, but he said that you gave up your journalistic objectivity to become too involved, too partisan with the events. For me, I thought that your passion really is what increases the value of the book to me. But I wonder what your reaction is to people who question you on that.
I think sometimes people have the idea that a journalist, and a journalist particularly as I was writing for The New Yorker in Egypt, you know, going to write that the book is going to be the definitive explanation of this is what it was, this is what happened, this is why it happened, let me tell you this. And that's not the kind of book I wanted to write. I wanted to write a book that was more impressionistic and anecdotal, that told you stories, that introduced you to people. And it's full of characters and conversations and moments and musings. And I wanted to sort of put the reader in the middle of all of that, in the middle of the melee and the mayhem and the confusion, and to describe in a way the event as it was and as we experienced it there. Which is to say, you don't know what's happening. It's quite confusing. It's not clear. And that's part of why it's interesting. And it's interesting as a journalist, it's an interesting kind of journalistic exercise to take a step away, take a step back from the analysis, from the kind of perfect analysis, and to say, you know, sometimes it's not clear and we don't know. And it's more interesting to examine the bits that don't add up, the bits that seem to kind of slip the moorings of sort of an absolute progression of events, or why this happened and then that happened. And in some ways, I think that's why I write in the first person, because it seems a little bit more honest and close to the ground to me. And I think that particularly when you're a writer trying to describe a different place, a different culture, a different time to readers, you know, you want to get them as close as you can to that place and time and different people. So I kind of avoided the grand and that analytical approach and went for you know, people and stuff lower to the ground. So it was a deliberate choice. And there are, if you want the kind of, you know, straight analysis of here are the characters, this is what the Muslim Brotherhood is, this is the army, blah, 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 you know, there are other books out there too. There isn't one way to write a description of a revolution, and I wanted to do it in a slightly different way. So sometimes you just have to kind of stick to your original vision.
And in many ways, I think it actually explained things better to me.
I agree with you. I think it's easier for me to understand a complicated and distant event if I'm reading a story about somebody. It's harder for me to absorb, you know, facts and subclauses. And I think I just, it's a, trying to communicate, trying to connect. I think it tends to work better through people and characters. I don't think it's the only way to do it. And I, you know, was aware that occasionally I sort of take a step back and do a little bit of sort of contextualization or to, you know, do a bit of background in the book, because I don't want people to be lost. But at the same time, I want to, you know, describe something that was enormously impressionist, made an enormous impression on me and was important to me. And I just wanted to describe a time and place, I think.
Well, you did a terrific job. And Wendell,
thank you.
And Wendell Stevenson, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about your wonderful book, Circling the Square, Stories from the Egyptian Revolution.
Thank you, Francesca.
Wendell Stevenson. Her book, Circling the Square, Stories from the Egyptian Revolution, was published by HarperCollins in August. You can find links to her reporting on the Egyptian Revolution for The New Yorker at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk about popular democracy here at home and, remember, Occupy Wall Street. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. After the Arab Spring came the American Autumn. Occupy Wall Street began in September of 2011 and took its inspiration from similar movements in Europe and the Middle East. In November of 2011, I spoke with one of the original organizers of Occupy Wall Street, Marina Citrin. We talked about an essay she wrote that was included in the first book about Occupy Wall Street that was titled This Changes Everything. Her essay was The Chills of Occupied Power, The First Month of Occupied Wall Street. A lawyer as well as a writer and activist, Citrin was a member of Occupy Wall Street's legal working group. She had no idea when she helped organize the first General Assembly in New York City, which turned into Occupy Wall Street, that Occupy would turn into a worldwide movement.
No, I had no idea, and I don't want to speak for everyone involved in planning it, but I don't think any of us really imagined. We definitely didn't imagine we were going to be part of launching a movement, but most of us didn't bring sleeping bags or tents even on the day of September 17th. We planned for one day.
And why do you think it took off like this at this time?
I'm not sure. I think there's been kind of bubbling under the surface a dissatisfaction, but I don't think it's accurate to just say it's a kind of anger or rage. I think it's a dissatisfaction, but a desire to talk, a desire to find one another more than anything. And I think that's what we're seeing in how people are organizing as well. It's not shouting and screaming in the streets. It's creating assemblies and talking to each other.
That really strikes me what you say, because the first time I went down there to Zuccotti Park, two things really struck me. One is that everybody was having these conversations.
Yeah. I mean, our intention in planning September 17th, even though the call was to occupy Wall Street, those of us organizing in Tompkins Square Park early on, we called ourselves the New York City General Assembly. And what we wanted to do was open space for discussion. What are people thinking? What are our alternatives? So the plan for the 17th was to have multiple assemblies and then one large assembly, which is what took off. It's what people were so excited by. And I think even though people did come intending to camp, I think the idea that this was going to be an open space of discussion with one another, finding one another, and that kind of looking at each other in the eyes and talking is what kept people in Zuccotti Park and kept more and more people coming to participate.
The second thing is diversity, but I don't want to get to that yet. I want to stay in this conversation for a minute, because another thing that you say in your essay, in This Changes Everything, The Chills of Popular Power, is while the experienced organizers never imagined something like this. The new people who came just took it for granted that this was taking off. So on these conversations, what I saw were conversations going on between old hands, people who've been around as long as I have, which has been a long time, and people who had never imagined that they would be at a demonstration ever in their lives.
I think that's one of the most exciting and beautiful parts of all of this, and sometimes some of the most challenging. But even on the day of the 17th, while it was a protest, and it's true to call it a demonstration, by later in the afternoon, it already started to feel a little bit different than just a demonstration. And there were people, for example, I can remember seeing one couple, and I spoke to them because they were from way upstate New York, and they came with a cooler that they had on wheels, and they'd brought a tent and sleeping bags. And they were not your typical either protesters or organizers. They came with the idea of doing something against Wall Street and wanting to be there. And I think it was people like that, when you talk about diversity, that really opened up the possibility of it becoming a movement.
You've been studying movements like this for a long time. You studied Argentina. You wrote the book Horizontalism, which is about what happened in Argentina. For our audience, kind of briefly describe what that was about.
In 2001, right after the economic crisis in Argentina, people began kind of in that moment of crisis also organizing and organizing assemblies in neighborhoods. People were taking over workplaces. And I'd kind of heard rumors or via different emails and things like that, that they were using this form called horizontalidad, which I hadn't heard of in Spanish, and I speak Spanish, and I hadn't heard of in English. And it's a kind of horizontal form of decision making. And so I decided to go to Argentina and check it out, because what I'd heard in the descriptions of what was happening sounded so exciting and sounded like something I would want to see in the world. So I kind of had trouble imagining that it was really true, that what you desire is actually happening. And I went to Argentina, and it was true. Unemployed people organizing in these horizontal ways, trying to meet their needs. People who were middle class or had been middle class and after the crisis were no longer, but were organizing in assemblies, standing on street corners, looking to one another to solve their problems together. Workers taking over their workplaces when the bosses left and running them without hierarchy, without managers, and making decisions together. So in all different social classes, people were coming together, and in all of these spaces in this horizontal way. So what I saw in Argentina and what we're seeing now, not just in the US, but in Greece and in Spain and around the world, the ways people are organizing in mass assemblies, looking at one another, creating kind of horizontal democracy is, I mean, it's in some ways I want to say it's intuitive, or there's something that's just happening in around the world, and this is how people are organizing. But I did see it first in 2001, 2002 in Argentina.
Now, the horizontalism experiment in Argentina is now 10 years old. Where is it now? And how can you contrast, or can you contrast, this nascent horizontalism, North American style, with a more mature movement, Latin American style?
I see so many similarities, and we have this wonderful opportunity now to learn so many of the lessons of what happened in Argentina. I was actually just in Greece with someone from the movements in Argentina, and we were sharing experiences on all different levels in that way. But the movements continue in Argentina. There are many, many fewer of the neighborhood assemblies, so people who had been in the middle class, and that urban organizing on the street corners is much less. But the way that people organize is the same. So as groups come together, they assume this horizontal form of organizing. Some people refer to it, when I was last there last year, people called themselves hijos of the 19th and 20th. And so children of the 19th and 20th. The 19th and 20th are the 2 days that the popular rebellion began. So it's this marking point that people refer to as this kind of rupture when things broke open and new ways of organizing happened. So they see this kind of direct lineage to that, and then organizing in horizontal ways. So right now, for example, in the Andean region, up and down Argentina, there are hundreds of assemblies that are being organized by people in the countryside, and it's against international mines that will exploit the environment, destroy people's livelihoods. So people are organizing, and they're coming together in assemblies using the language of horizontalidad. It's just, this is the way when people resist, they come together, not just resist, but create something in that space. So it continues in Argentina, and the way we're seeing it around the world, I think it will also continue. It just kind of makes sense as a way of organizing.
It makes sense, and yet so many in the media are just completely flummoxed. They cannot get this. Where are the leaders? How is this going to continue without leaders? So let me ask you, how is this going to continue without leaders?
You know, I think, well, the mainstream media is totally confused because we're so accustomed to being told what to do, and there's a hierarchy, and someone tells someone who tells someone, and that's just the way of things in the world. So in horizontal organizing, we decide things together. I don't think it's totally accurate to say there are no leaders. I think, and this is something we've been discussing, we, people who are in Occupy Wall Street and different movements, the distinction between not having power over each other and not having leaders. So there are people who have experience, and as the movement becomes more diverse, we have a lot of people who are participating who have experience, you know, who maybe were in the civil rights movement or who are in the labor movement, you know, in radical forms of the labor movement, and we have a lot to learn from them. And when they speak, they're heard in a different way. There's a different kind of quiet when someone speaks about race, who was an organizer in SNCC, for example. So that person has a kind of leadership quality, and I think it's really important to talk about that. But that doesn't mean they have power over the group. It just means when we listen differently. Or perhaps people act differently, and then we have to think seriously about how we can hold one another accountable as well. And so these are newer conversations that are coming up. But I definitely think there are forms of leadership, and that's okay as long as we're transparent about it and we're not using it in a way that has power. It's the part that the media doesn't understand is, how is it that we don't have power over each other? How is it that people aren't making decisions for other people? It's the hierarchy part that they don't understand how we can function without. And in fact, people do better without hierarchy. And I mean better in the sense of, when you're in a consensus-based, not absolute consensus, but trying to come to agreement and compromise with one another, the more we talk and the more we come to a kind of agreement, the more likely we are to actually carry out that agreement, because we've all been a part of it and we all feel okay with it. When you vote or someone tells you what to do, a whole segment of the people involved in that discussion feel unhappy. So they're very unlikely to go and do whatever that decision is if they don't like it. If everyone feels pretty good about it and they were a part of making that decision together, they're more likely to actually do it. So even on the question of efficiency, that is often raised as, you know, one of the problems of these movements is they're not efficient, or direct democracy is not efficient. That's really just untrue. More people participate when they are a part of deciding what's going to happen in their lives.
When they take ownership and initiative.
Absolutely. When it becomes a part of, you're a part of the decision, and so you're more likely to then act on that decision rather than someone telling you what to do and you go home and you decide, well, do I want to do that or not? It's a different question than, well, I helped to make this proposal. Some of my ideas are embedded in the proposal. So, yes, I want to carry it out.
And yet there's also a lot of spontaneity. You know, people will break off. I've been at a number of the demonstrations. I was there November 17th. You know, people can do things spontaneously. How does one strike this balance between collective action and individual or small group action?
I think that is tricky. Part of it is through conversations together collectively. And we do have, from the beginning, principles of unity, and talk about things around those things that kind of hold us together. So not demands, but those principles that hold us together. So, for example, people do not act in violent ways towards other people. And that's something that's part of our principles, and people have stood by that in all of these different demonstrations or actions, or when people go off and do individual actions. There's a kind of respect for that solidarity with each other.
We're talking with Marina Citrin. She has contributed to the first book, this new book, This Changes Everything, the first book about Occupy Wall Street and the 99% movement. And she is also the author of the book Horizontalism, which is a study of a very similar kind of movement that emerged out of the crisis, the economic crisis in Argentina in 2001. The other thing that really struck me, let's see, my first experience was October 5th. That's where the unions were, and I thought, okay, lots of diversity here because so many of the unions in New York, you know, are representing workers of color. And when I went to Occupy Wall Street, it seemed that over the period of time that I went there, it became more and more diverse. You know, African Americans and Asians and white folks in a way I have never seen before. You know, I've been around these movements for a long time. They've been very segregated for the most part. Even the civil rights movement had its white groups and it had its African American groups. How did this happen?
I don't know exactly how it happened. It's actually bringing tears to my eyes because I come from a multiracial family and parents who were involved in the civil rights movement. So it is so incredibly important. And looking at history, it's been some of our biggest challenges, whether it's around class or race, gender, sexual orientation. And there was the moment when we were going to be evicted from the plaza. That's not what they called it. It's when they were going to have the police were going to allow the cleaners to come in and they were going to evict the park temporarily. And by 5 and 6 o'clock in the morning, the plaza was full to overflowing. There were people all over the sidewalks, on the streets, and it was more diverse, and it had increasingly become more diverse. But that morning, there were people in suit jackets on their way to work. There were Black and Latino workers who were there. There were African-American women dressed up in heels. There were people with beards, and there were people there with children. It was the most incredibly diverse group, and it continues to be really diverse. But that moment for me was this turning point moment of not only are we a movement, but this is different. This is something, I mean, that this changes everything. The title of the book really is significant because something completely different has happened. And I think perhaps part of it is related to this idea that it is an all-inclusive movement, with the exception of people who do harm to other people, whether that's economic or physical, that kind of harm. But it is an all-inclusive kind of movement. And I believe it's also linked to the forms of democracy we're using, that it is a participatory form where people come and can talk and can listen to each other. And that's something that we don't have in our society. And I don't think we can underestimate that, the fact that this isn't a democracy based on actual participation. And that's also true in unions, in a lot of organizations and groups that I've been involved in the past, radical groups or progressive groups that don't have that same form of participation. And people desperately want to hear one another and to speak to one another. And I think that's part of what opens it and allows it to be more diverse. And again, I am going to stress the facilitation part, that when we have assemblies, that they're not just wide open, that we are really conscientious about who's speaking, about thinking about power and making sure there's space for all people to speak. And I think that's really important in the different groups all over the country, that we need to pay a lot of attention. The idea that we have a stack and that word is used is like a deck of cards. You know, I kind of visualize it in that way, and that you shuffle it so that people who want to speak, it's not just a list. It's someone keeps those names of people who want to speak, but paying attention to the diversity of those names. So you shuffle the stack so that if 4 men have spoken and 3 more men raise their hands and then a woman raises her hand, the woman goes to the top of the stack, for example. So people whose voices are heard less are moved forward. And part of that idea is also that the more one sees someone like yourself speaking, you're more likely to speak. So as a woman, when I see more women playing a leading role, I'm more likely to step forward than if I don't. And that's the idea with stacks. So these things that can seem small, or that the media definitely doesn't understand, or thinks we're kind of fetishizing some kind of process, they're all very consciously intended tools to open as much democratic space as possible.
Marina Citrin is the author of 2 books, They Can't Represent Us, Reinventing Democracy from Greece to Occupy, co-written with Dario Azzolini and published in 2014 by Verso Books, also Everyday Revolutions, Horizontalism and Autonomy in Argentina, which came out in 2012. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.